platforms can't just be thought about in isolation.
Sure.
At an organization like mine or an enterprise, it sits within a wider ecosystem. And so even if I deliver you the fastest, shiniest car, and in this case, Kubernetes runs the container, if the rest of the application lifecycle also isn't simple and easy and low barrier to entry, people won't get to the platform. Mm-hmm. And therefore the KPI of business value hasn't been met. So if I only look at KPIs looking at the platform, I might be getting loads of green ticks. But if the developer can't get on to the platform, we still haven't delivered that end profit.
Welcome to another edition of Cloud Unfiltered. This is a special edition in KubeCon Paris.
Oui, à Paris.
Yeah, yeah.
Bonjour.
And I have a special guest here. And introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Rachel Wanacott, and I'm the product owner of the Kubernetes platform at Fidelity International.
Fidelity. So that's a small company. Yeah.
Yeah, medium-sized, I'd say. So we're roughly 13,000 employees total.
I figured, I actually thought it was bigger than that, honestly.
Yeah, so I think because we're a smaller branch, so we are a sister company of Fidelity Management Retail.
Gotcha.
So we're owned by the same family, but we are very much distinct businesses.
Gotcha. Well, the real reason I had you on is because you understand the real complexities of this. So explain a little bit about what you do in your kind of day-to-day world.
My pleasure. Platform engineering is the topic that we're here to talk about, and that's very much how I currently identify, but have identified really for the last decade.
Yeah.
We've just had a little chat on the side about how part of the reason for that is that we've given it a name, but it is very much something I believe that's been in the ecosystem for a long time. So day-to-day for me, it's trying to deliver a platform that ultimately drives business value, and keeping our priorities focused on that. As someone that used to wear a engineering hat, so I was very much full-time hands-on until about 10 months ago, I know how easy it is to be excited by the elegance of technology and all of the plethora of possibilities that there is to build with technology. But actually for a business, particularly in the current climate, I think everyone's very aware that there's lots going on both in the financial markets, but also in the tech community, where we need to be more cost-focused. So value for me is that number one frame of mind. To put that into perspective though, the way that we deliver value is to internal customers. So my customers will be what we call workloads, which is essentially application teams or developers. Some of them are following the product model. Some of them are less mature, some of them are more mature. So I have to think across that full scale. Typically we're looking at a bell curve and going for that 80 in the middle and maybe ignoring the 20 on the either side. But at Fidelity, we're moving towards a slightly hybrid operating model, and the Kubernetes platform sits on one side. So prior to this role, I was working in the Amazon Web Services team as a senior engineer and driving that direction. And that was much more about giving autonomy to the customers through the automated delivery of fully fledged mini data centers, or as you would be familiar with, AWS accounts, essentially. Whereas the Kubernetes model is looking to give customers a more fully fledged experience, for lack of a better word. We're using the hotel analogy. So people can simply focus on building applications to a really high standard, which hopefully drives business value and financial profit. So the platform team is taking more onus for the designing, management, and securing of all of the infrastructure to allow application developers to be specialists rather than being more akin to the DevOps model. Whereas those people still exist in the organization, and we recognize that's valid, but we want to give teams the choice. You don't have to do everything yourself, but equally, you don't have to choose for us to do it all for you, and giving that fork in the road for our teams.
Yeah, so you brought up an interesting topic about DevOps. I think the reason why we've shifted away from like defining DevOps and DevOps engineers is because everybody has a different definition
yes.
of it. So, you know, people have morphed different ways. Companies have different people that either started as a developer or started out in infrastructure and kind of merged the either way. You know, so it's been very hard to define
absolutely
what that means. So
I think that's really interesting because there's four terms that we can dive into that are all interrelated. And if you're hiring, actually, I think there's so much overlap that it can be difficult just to use one word. So you've got SRE.
Yeah.
So your site reliability engineers, which I also identify with.
Yes.
Then you've got your DevOps engineers, but you've also got your software engineers. But really the core skills that I would be looking to hire for actually overlap across all three. And in many ways, I think it's a mindset more than it's a skill set or a label. So site reliability engineering is in the name. You want to think about it being highly available. Is it scalable? Are you confident that your platform is doing what it wants to do? But you can implement that using DevOps methodologies, which is much more focused on that interrelationship, the socio-technical side, culture, if you will, mm-hmm. between development and operations. So in the teams that I run, we always do DevOps. If your definition is that we have that blend, someone is not only going to do ops and someone else is only going to do development. We try and have everyone pair. So we're really keen on that pair programming, but we do it across our operations as well, partly for knowledge sharing, but also to keep that culture within. And then finally, it's that platform engineering, which I think focuses more on what you want to deliver to the customer. So that's the overall package. So you're doing SRE using DevOps methodologies to deliver platform engineering, or a platform that, in my case, fingers crossed, delivers business value.
I think I just heard the best definition of all those terms that I've ever heard. So I think that's amazing.
I didn't look at my notes. I think it's such a passionate thing in the community right now. The number of blogs, podcasts, YouTube videos, that it can be difficult to pinpoint a single definition. And so my advice to people when they're talking about it is actually in the conversation to redefine what they're thinking when they say it. So much like with a team, when you have acceptance criteria, you want to agree your definition of done. Any conversations I'm having at KubeCon, I'm actually asking, what does it mean to you? So that when we're having the conversation, I understand where they're coming from, because there are different lenses. You've got the engineer hat, the product owner hat, the VC hat, and those people do look at it slightly differently, I believe.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you're talking about going back to platform engineering, it seems like a really complex beast to tame when you're thinking about how to create this secure platform and how to make it scalable and how to do all that. That's a lot of
many things to think about.
So how do you even start to approach that?
So I think what we tried to do at the start was think about how we make the thinnest viable platform, which is just the next sexy word for MVP. I think MVP's got a bit of a bad rap. And so when I say TVP, what I'm really saying is it's as much about saying no and being confident to say no and articulate why you're saying no as it is to say yes. So all of the talks have quite rightly at KubeCon focused on how platform engineering is about your customers. But in the same way that we don't know what customers want, the customer doesn't always know what they want. So when we're starting out with those things that you've mentioned, security, scaling, and MVP, trying to prioritize is difficult if you haven't got any user feedback. So what we did was, in the context of my organization, was look at our existing platforms and actually think about what the developers wanted there and then fill those gaps. So if we already have a platform that's doing what they need, it doesn't really matter that Kubernetes is really cool. That's not enough of a reason to build it. So the main feedback that we had from customers, and this is quite a large portion, was they wanted to be application specialists and they wanted more help with some of that core infrastructure that could be delivered by the Kubernetes platform, particularly with things like, just take my app, here's my container, run it for me. I don't wanna scale it. I don't wanna check where the traffic's being routed. I don't wanna do chaos engineering. I want to be confident that proxy and DNS just works out of the box. I don't want to understand your service mesh. I think many of those things just should be transparent.
Yeah.
So we thought about what are the core services, the things you can't not have. So that is things like DNS, proxy, routing, network security, scalability, is it highly available? And for me, making sure that all of those things are automated. And that the monitoring is live, that we have advanced notification. So we have very mature platforms, like I mentioned, on AWS. We used to have Cloud Foundry on premises, which is now end of life. And we also have an Azure platform. So we're really fortunate that in the organization, we do have a lot of maturity from platform engineers to know what good looks like. So for me, if you think about the stack, it's how far away from the application developer do they want us to be? So if they really only care about the application, that leaves pretty much the full stack for us to think about. So for me, networking is the foundation of everything. Mm-hmm. I avoided it like the plague for the first 2 years of my career. And I had a really great manager who said, Rachel, you need to figure this out. And then I fell in love building an SD-WAN. But I think everything that we do comes back to ensuring low latency, because we're an international organization, so we have lots of intra-region and inter-region connectivity requirements. But then security, as a financial regulated company, so the FCA regulates us in the financial services, it's very strict. And there's also lots of requirements for things like cloud exit strategy. So there are constraints. The CNCF published a platform engineering maturity paper, which I loved, a talk from the platform engineering day yesterday.
Yeah.
And it really resonated with me that as an enterprise, we face lots of the constraints from compliance and security. And then in the middle, it's like, what do our developers want? And then on the right-hand side, it's what do we want to build as platform engineers? And so my job as product owner is to reconcile all of these wants, needs, and desires to be simply priorities. So to summarize, the TLDR is for me making sure that the network is secure and resilient, and that all the basic functionality of Kubernetes, so not really thinking too much about the add-ons, all work automated and can scale.
Yeah, yeah.
And then adding on appropriate add-ons, but only for the simple needs. So to give you an example of Cilium, we're using that as a CNI, mm-hmm. but we're not yet using the service mesh because we have only a handful of customers, so we don't need the service mesh. Mm-hmm. But my engineer hat is thinking, oh, I'd really love to build a service mesh, but that's going to come with time. So
yeah, yeah.
TVP first,
yep.
and then very much iterative and based on customer feedback. So my number one challenge at the moment is getting enough customers on to actually get that customer feedback.
So, you know, you do work for a big company, and a lot of times there's KPIs and things like that,
yep.
to measure you on. Are some of the measurements, would they be like, okay, well, a developer now gets more jobs done because the platform is taking care of some of those things, or you're more efficient in spinning things up? Like, how do you
That's
determine that?
That's a great question. So I think there's a lot of buzz at the moment about DevRel, DevX.
Yeah.
If you look at me on LinkedIn, that's something I've actually stated that keeps me up at night. It's super important. I think when we're talking about platforms, it's very easy to be inward looking and try and measure the performance of the platform. But actually, if what I'm talking about here is business value,
yeah, yeah.
you have to measure like that as your true KPI. So to be really mercenary, that's financial delivery. Like, are we making a profit? And then when you scale back, you have to ask yourself, well, how much is the platform driving that profit? So for me, and something I'd like to think more about following KubeCon to articulate exactly how I feel about this, is platforms can't just be thought about in isolation.
Sure.
At an organization like mine, or an enterprise, it sits within a wider ecosystem. And so even if I deliver you the fastest, shiniest car, and in this case, Kubernetes runs the container, if the rest of the application lifecycle also isn't simple and easy and low barrier to entry, people won't get to the platform. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the KPI of business value hasn't been met. So if I only look at KPIs looking at the platform, I might be getting loads of green ticks. But if the developer can't get on to the platform, we still haven't delivered that end profit. So I think while it's great to see some of those other metrics for developers, like how many lines of code,
yeah.
although I think that can incentivize gamification,
yes.
so I personally wouldn't advocate for those. I think for me, it's ultimate speed. So you need to have a product owner or a BA, have whatever flavor that you run your
yeah,
team,
yeah.
needs to have a very on the ground feel of the productivity of the team. And actually putting a hard number to that is quite challenging.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you do a retrospective on a Friday, if you know your team, which hopefully you do as a leader, you'll feel the difference. You know, on a Friday when the week's gone well and people feel satisfied, which is great for retention. But equally, you know when there's friction because people are grumpy, people are short. There's a tangible for me vibe on a Friday if we've had a week that's had blockers. So as part of the strategy working group, we're actually using OKRs now.
Mm-hmm.
So objectives and then key results,
yep.
rather than just KPIs, and then breaking down those OKRs into actions. And for us, a really key thing at the moment is making sure that somebody is aligned to those actions. So even if there isn't a solid numeric metric, that person can still give qualitative feedback for how we're delivering on that action.
So going back a little bit to the platform part of it, how do you ensure that, you know, you're making this platform as secure as possible, and that, you know, all the things are just cross your fingers, it's good.
So I think there's two aspects for us. So
yeah.
we're building on Amazon EKS.
Yeah.
So there's obviously all the levels of security to think about at a platform level. So IaaS in this case, but equally there's a lot of requirements within the cluster. So some really interesting conversations I had last night at the iSurveillance party talking about Cilium and EPF was that a lot of people are actually focusing very much on the security of the underlying platform. And this would be equally true for AKS, but I'm going to speak within the context of Amazon. Lots of people thinking, okay, well, least privilege for Amazon, authentication into Amazon. What's my network traffic doing within Amazon? You know, have I got it in a private subnet? Are we doing multi-VPC?
Mm-hmm.
And the first question I said to someone that I've met who's building a cluster on Amazon was, what about your network isolation in the cluster? Silence. I'm like, really though,
yeah.
you know, do you have a plan? And they're like, well, we're not sure. We might go multi-cluster and therefore we'd be single tenant. And I was like, well, for me, as someone that's doing multi-tenant, potentially large scale multi-tenant in a single cluster, absolute hard requirement that we have network isolation. And so we're doing all of those good principles within Amazon. And I'm fortunate that my previous team does a lot of that for us out of the box. They deliver us the Amazon account with much of that baked in. So our focus then is sort of ingress into the cluster, right? So there's an element of doing security there because you can authenticate, but also you've got to make sure that if you're doing a service mesh that you know where your traffic is coming from. But for me, that TVP, the first thing we wanted to ensure was that if you're workload A and I'm workload B, and because we're delivering in namespaces, you've got a one-to-one mapping of this workload in a namespace to me, a one-to-one mapping in a namespace. You were using the Cilium network policies to say, we both have to allow the traffic. So if you want to chat to me and you've been like, hey, Rach, let's have a conversation. I'm like, no, thank you.
That's pretty much how it goes.
Right? It still doesn't happen, of course. And then on top of that, having assumption of levels. So I'm not articulating that particularly well, but essentially what we mean is if there's a platform level policy, which we own as the platform team, and then we give self-service to the customer so you can change your workload policies, we will supersede you. So we can both say, hey, let's have a conversation. But if organizationally we've said, no, those two workloads can never communicate, that will take precedence. So there's like two layers of security there with like the network policy. And what was really nice in this conversation with Cilium is that actually the way they implement the CNI is quite simple. A lot of Kubernetes is arguably very complex, not complicated, complex.
Yeah, yeah.
And so if we want to deliver a platform, the first iteration of this platform, just using Cilium as the CNI and just ensuring that network isolation is like that first most simple way that we can start to achieve that. And I think there's many other aspects of security. So we could talk about vulnerabilities and containers and the difference between running things in the cloud versus on premises and the different types of networks. But the real fundamental unit in multi-tenancy is security between workloads at the network level.
So, you know, I was just thinking about something that you said, which was, you know, getting people to use the platform, you know, because honestly, people will find a way. So even though you built it and they're starting to come, you know, the first sign of trouble that you get, they're going to figure out a way around that platform, because if there's some inhibitor, they don't want to, they're done. So how do you prevent that? And how do you entice people to come?
This is a really good question. So there's two smaller answers that fit nicely together. So I read a blog recently, unfortunately I don't remember the author, that talks about how shadow IT is just the IT you're not using yet. So actually sometimes it's interesting to understand the workarounds, because that might help dictate what the next iteration of the platform is. So rather than trying to mandate, which I don't believe in, or block people or get around it, actually take that as feedback and see if you can bring their ingenuity into your platform. So that's the first small answer. The second small answer is leaning on that CNCF platform maturity article that talks about the reasons why you might not get adoption. And they have a really nice matrix where you've got the different aspects that you're measuring and then how mature you are across the top. And they said that the one that is anchored, so the one that gets left behind, is adoption. So you could call that the adoption anchor. And the three reasons that they were talking about to do with this are all quite difficult to tackle. So the first one for me, I think actually is my biggest challenge, and that's lack of confidence. Now that lack of confidence could stem from a developer that has been asked to do Kubernetes that's never done Kubernetes before. Naturally, they're less confident. It could be because it's a new platform. They just simply are like, we'll let some other people try it out and then we'll onboard later. You know, I'm someone that often pulls things from GitHub 2 weeks after release, not straight away. So I can agree with that. Or lack of confidence that it's going to offer them anything more than what they're already doing. So if they're migrating from one platform to another, and that's where we need to have a little bit of marketing. So that's probably our biggest challenge right now. And a lot of that is to do with the fact we don't have as mature, probably, a development community in Kubernetes, very mature in AWS and doing cloud native directly onto Amazon. But I think in the containerization space, that's probably a little bit newer. So there's going to need to be, for me, an education piece. But then you have to think about the scaling and the bandwidth of the platform team. And should we be just focusing on the engineering, or can we also be evangelists? And that's a balance that's forever difficult to be pragmatic. And then I think I made some notes here because I knew this would be a question, was insufficient features. Now, how do you just define what MVP is? very hard to do. What are those core requirements? So if you think about Kubernetes in its simplest terms being an orchestration tool, what are those core site reliability engineering principles? Well, you want it to be highly available. If you're an enterprise like ours, you probably have 6.9s, i.e. you never want it to go down.
Yep.
You need to have rolling upgrades. That should be seamless and totally transparent to the user. In the utopia, you might even be multi-cloud, and the customer shouldn't even care whether it's running on Amazon or Azure at the back end. They just say, here's my container. Can you run it? So all of the aspects of scaling and availability that mean the customer don't know where it's running, when it's running, or what version of infrastructure, just that it runs successfully. That's the minimum requirement. And then everything else for me is a bell and a whistle. But for a customer that maybe has come from something else like Cloud Foundry, which actually covers more of the application lifecycle. So to be really clear, if you think about writing your code, testing your code, deploying your code, building an image, scanning an image, storing an image, and then running the image, Cloud Foundry actually does sort of the last four steps of that, whereas Kubernetes only runs the image. Mm-hmm. So I'm saying to application developers, you need to do a little bit more, which if you remember my use case of actually we want to be application specialists, we don't want to be infrastructure specialists, that's a little bit diametrically opposed. So the insufficient features also is potentially a challenge. And the way that we're tackling this is by having a very public request for features. So across all of the portfolios within the business, so everyone can see what everyone else is asking for. And what we're hoping to drive here is standardization and consistency. So if you have an idea and I see it, I might be like, oh, actually, that's better than what I was thinking. Let's not build this bespoke custom thing over here. Let's put a request to say, actually, your idea was good. And we'll try and build based on a voting system.
And that's how
system.
Community works, even in the open source community.
Exactly. So and we're kind of stealing the GitHub model for that there. And then the final one was insufficient DevRel. Now, that really aligns to what I've just mentioned with that application lifecycle. So if they only want to focus on building an application, they probably don't want to get involved in that middle part of building the image or securing the image in terms of actually setting up their pipelines. They can give us all the information and tell us what, in like a build pack as well in the Cloud Foundry community, we're sort of taking that model as well into Kubernetes. They need to know what they need to run, but they shouldn't necessarily be responsible for maintaining the pipeline itself. So could we give them a pipeline that they just give us declarative config and they tell us, I want X, Y, Z. That could be everything from their namespace name, like do they want a database to be connected? What's their CPU and memory requirements? Like really basic requirements as declarative config and just plumb it through a pipeline. But then someone needs to take ownership for running and maintaining that pipeline. So there's a question mark for me at the moment of where's the natural ownership of that? And so I think we're delivering a very good platform at the moment, but I predict in the future that most of the friction won't be the platform itself. It will be the steps
to get to the
platform and all of the things around it. So as we have more requirements onboarding, the applications will likely get more complex. So rather than simple static websites, they could be data intensive applications, which are suitable for Kubernetes because of scaling. But they're going to have lots of other downstream requirements that could be back on premises. And then it's a case of, okay, well, how easy have we made the network connectivity there for them to understand? If there's someone that has said they don't want to understand infrastructure, they want to be focused on applications, because holistically our organization, simply by virtue of being a long running, quite large scale, is a bit more organically built, right? You know, if you're a startup of 10 people, I can just go and knock on your door and be like, hey, what's the deal with the database? Whereas in our organization, they might have to contact an entirely separate team to get recommendations about their schemas and their tables. And partly what our team is doing with the wider organization is trying to make all of this process smoother. I think the term that people are using here is the golden path. You know, can we string together all those stages of the application lifecycle together in a way? And for me, the metric or the KPI will be, what's the number of hops? Can you tell I'm networking? you know, do they have to speak to different teams at different stages? Because the more people they have to speak to, the slower it's going to be and the more potential for friction. So reducing the number of hops on the application lifecycle for me would be an achievement for the end of the year.
Yeah. So you know, just to come off with some of the ideas that you had there, one of the things I think is always a barrier to entry is that people are really religious about the tools they use too.
Yes.
So you know, like I used to have a cloud management platform I was responsible for that was before Terraform, And it was really cool. You could visually graph everything together and you could recreate all of your solutions on multiple clouds and all this kind of stuff. But then came along Terraform and people were like, well, I want to use Terraform, you know? And so people, once you take away their tool that they love, they're going to be like really, really strong-willed about that.
I think it's human nature to be protective of what you know. And if you take that back to human psychology, it's really coming down to survival and fear. So if you already know something and you know that you do it well, it's not necessarily even that you believe consciously that it's a better tool. It's just that you know you can deliver a better outcome with that tool. So typically the way we're trying to facilitate those conversations about tools is to ask the question of, well, what's the outcome that we want? So with CI/CD tooling, you know, I'm a big fan of Concourse. I used that for a long time. I really like Circle CI. Mm-hmm. When I was working in AWS, I actually ended up using a lot of Code Pipeline and Code Build, because if I'm paying Amazon and I'm building in Amazon, it just kind of makes sense to do stuff out the box. And even though originally they were less feature rich, it had all the features I needed.
Yeah.
So it's like mapping the features of the tool to the outcome. So in our case, really what we're trying to achieve is more agility. I think every organization is probably trying to achieve that. So speed. So what's the end-to-end time from someone writing their code to it being in production? Not just in dev or staging or on the master branch, but actually running in production so that an end user, someone out, you know, in the world is giving money to the company. That is the full end-to-end. And in theory, any tool could do that. And I have a really great friend of mine and colleague, his name's Tim, and we often say, it's just a software engineering problem, right? The tool, in a good engineer, even if the tool is quote unquote bad, could still find a way to make that tool deliver the outcome, because it's just a software engineering problem. So when people get very tied to an individual tool, and I admit that I have been tied to tools in the past, you have to look at where you're going. And so even when there are tools that have disadvantages, does that disadvantage outweigh the delivering of the outcome? Or is it simply that it's less technically elegant? Now, the only caveat I will add here is that if that less technical elegance is a security flaw, then yes, then that's something we should be talking about. But if it's simply just a preference, I think you have to ask yourself how much that means to you and why you're in the industry. So if you're here to solve problems, you should really be able to do that with any tool. And I would challenge a software engineer on that and say, well, we're just solving a problem, find a way to do it with a tool, versus someone that simply wants to tinker and build the most elegant solution. And I think those people naturally filter out and often end up building their own things separately. If you have that stronger preference, you'd need to then be a lead. And the bigger your organization, the harder it's going to be to find consensus. And there's always going to be a vacillation even between going for one tool and achieving complete standardization, hopefully to democratize the tool, because you could potentially wrap it up as a managed service and send it out, versus giving teams full autonomy, which probably will create better developer satisfaction and retention. But if you've got 600 application teams, you're probably going to get to a point where there's too much complexity and complication in the system by having that many tools. And if there's license costs, to bring it right back to that business value, if the end outcome is profit, do you want to be paying N plus number of license fees when you could be using one that's potentially cloud native or even open source?
Yeah, I mean, the things I think about when I think about that is that, you know, there still is an education piece to that. Mm. And you have to fit in, what does it cost to re-educate somebody around that tool? And is that worthwhile too? Yeah. You know, because there's that aspect of it.
Yeah, definitely. So when I went into the team that I'm in now, so I've been leading this team for about 10 months, lots of the tools they were using were not my personal preference. But they're already using it. And the ecosystem is already using it. And they're doing it well. And it's delivering business value. So really, what did I have? What leg did I have to stand on to say, well, actually, I'd really rather that we use this language. I prefer that you use this CI/CD tool. The only point at which those two conversations start becoming relevant are if there's, say, a hiring shortage. So if you've got a skill set within an organization, but that's not market, like up to date with the market, and therefore you're struggling to hire new people and you've got people leaving, then you might need to pivot. I'm deliberately not really using any language names here because this will be relevant in 10 years' time, 20 years' time when there are different languages. But like, let's say you've got Language X in the team and everyone's very proficient at Language X, but no one else in the world really is using this language anymore. You're then going to have to really focus on that team always being that team. And we know within the tech industry that people move around quite a lot. It's good to move around, good for vitality, new ideas, to be challenged by different people. So I think choosing tools that are popular enough doesn't need to be the most popular tool, but it then needs to be wiggle room for you to grow the team or expand. So that'd be one consideration. And then the other consideration was, how well does that tool integrate with the rest of your ecosystem? So some tools have simply better interfaces, mm-hmm. or are quite agnostic to integration. And if you're building on a particular platform, how well does it integrate? So to go back to that example of CodePipeline, when I was building in Amazon, CodePipeline and CodeBuild were a no-brainer because they integrated seamlessly with the rest of the ecosystem. And initially when we did the proof of concept, people were like, oh, well, it's way less feature-rich than Concourse. And I was like, but do we need any of those other features? Mm-hmm. And after we did the analysis, we're like, actually, we don't. We can solve the problem, the software engineering problem, with this tool. It's cheaper because it's running in Amazon. We've already got a pre-existing relationship. We don't have to change any of our interfaces or our integration. Therefore, it's the better fit. I don't like the tool as much at the time. I was still really obsessed with how beautiful Concourse, they have a UI. It's a lovely UI. You can see all your dependencies mapped, and that's really lovely from a information radiator perspective. And at that time, CodePipeline didn't have that. Mm-hmm. But did we want to run Concourse on an EC2 instance in our account and spend more money? No, probably not. Yeah. So I think you have to look at the team and where they're at in terms of skill level. You've got to think a little bit further forward, i.e. are these skills going to be relevant that the team can continue to exist and can you hire? But also, can you meet your acceptance criteria? So the minimum number of features required to deliver that business value.
And I love, you know, one of the things you talked about, I think is not talked about enough or is not approached in this way, and that is outcomes. Mm. Because too many people say, I need to create or understand this particular platform. I need to do something with this platform. Mm. And really, you know, when you look at applications, it really is all the needs of the application. And not enough people take it from that perspective, that what does it need? Does it need scalability? Does it need to be multi-zone? Does it need to be regional? Does it need to have load balancing? Does it need to have all these things? And so I love that you guys approach it that way, because, you know, too many people like design for a specific platform.
Yeah, and I'll be really vulnerable with you that I didn't always think in that way. And it's very much been an evolution of my own maturity as a software engineer, but also now going into the role that I'm in. And, you know, if any of my team listen to this, they'll recognize me saying, with my engineering hat on. And quite often I'm facilitating conversations where we're talking about technical excellence, and it's something that we can achieve. And quite often it's also something that we could achieve not that expensively, but it's still more than we need. And having to be aggressive almost as a product owner to say, if we want to move fast, we should only ever deliver the minimum for the outcome. Yeah, okay, we can make it look a bit nicer, but that's half a day's worth of work. And you cost half a day's worth of salary that actually we could be moving on to the next thing. And I know it's frustrating for them, because a year ago, had I been the technical lead being told this, I would have been frustrated. So I'm trying to lead with transparency. So talking with my different hats deliberately to say, look, this is what I think of the solution.
Do you tell people which hat you have?
I literally put the hat on. It's a metaphorical hat, but I'm often doing this where, you know, so it was with Cilium, where I was like, with my engineer's hat on, I'm desperate to get into a POC for a service mesh. But looking at the number of customers we have, given that most of them are quite simple web applications that aren't particularly dependent on microservices, we don't need to facilitate that communication between services yet. Therefore, we don't have a business use case for service mesh. We might later, but right now, let's just use Cilium as the CNI. And that's the product owner hat. So sometimes when I'm saying no, which goes back to that TVP point, it's not a no, we will never do it. It's a no, right now, it doesn't meet the business value. Or typically in the context of my team, it's no, it doesn't meet the acceptance criteria. Scope creep is probably the biggest challenge that I've seen over my last 10 years of engineering, because we love the job. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't mean to scope creep, but, you know, if you're in the code and you're like, oh, I could add this extra thing. Mm-hmm. And that's why test-driven development became popular, because you really focused on just delivering the simplest line of code or function that met like the minimum need. And if your test is only going to say yes once that's passed, that's the thing that you're going after. But I think in architecture, we haven't got like a test-driven architecture approach where you have that, you know, binary yes,
maybe
no.
Maybe there should be.
Gosh, that'd be one to think about. But that's what I'm doing when I read tickets. It's reading the acceptance criteria again and asking, is that the minimum? Because sometimes even when we write tickets, you know, we do like a weekly planning session, it's hard not to add in extra pieces. And sometimes customers want extra things as well. So we have a template where we actually ask them for the business value. So two of the questions, there are many, but two of them to mention are, is there something else in the organization that already exists that could do this for you? Yes or no? And if the answer is yes, the follow-up question is,
why are you bothering me?
You know, how prohibitive is it for you to keep using that? So to think about databases, and we have a really large number of different databases that you're using, but people have preferences. You know, it might be great to move towards a cloud native database offering that we're building, but actually if you can use the database on premises for now, can you onboard to the platform and get familiar with Kubernetes and give us some feedback? Please give us some feedback in the meantime while we're building that database solution, rather than waiting to onboard for that perfect database solution. So it comes down to, can you get to prod so that our app is running, that somebody in the world is going to give us some money, hopefully driving a profit? And I think the longer you work in an organization, the more you realize that there are different customers and there are different areas of business value. So the developer is still someone that I need to think about the value that I'm delivering, but we also need to think about the end value, and it's weighing up, how much is the developer experience important if we're then not delivering end user value, right? So if there's no end user value, everything else is less important. And it's reprioritizing my personal desires as an engineer who loves writing code and tinkering with what's actually helping our organization to still exist in 20 years' time.
So I have this new segment that I'm doing on here. It's called Buzzworthy Buzzwordless.
Okay.
So I'm going to give you a couple terms, and you can tell me if they're buzzworthy or buzzworthless.
Okay.
So we'll go old school, and I'll do DevOps.
Buzzworthy.
Okay. And why?
I think it stands the test of time, and much like platform engineering was being done before we had names for it, I believe that's what we were doing for DevOps. And in a talk last year, I did say that I felt that platform engineering was simply the evolution of DevOps, because ultimately the reason that we wanted to bring development and operations together was to build a better outcome. And in that case, my outcome was a platform.
So then my second question was platform engineering.
Ooh, buzzworthless.
Really?
Yeah. For me, it's superfluous. I'd say it's implicit in what I'm doing, but that's very personal to me. And yeah, the fact that my whole career actually in technology after I left astrophysics is in platform engineering. So for me, I was kind of like, duh. But I like the fact that it being named has opened conversations.
We gave it a name.
And, you know, humans love to give things names. But for me personally, it hasn't changed my outlook. It's just a label.
Yeah. So the other question I'd like to ask here is, since we're at KubeCon, is what excites you? Like what's exciting that you found? I'm sure
at
a lot.
KubeCon?
Yes.
Wow, so many things. I think the socio-technical passion that I'm seeing coming out of the community, particularly from people that are still hands-on. Typically in the past, there's been the people-focused folk and the tech-focused folk. And I think I even said to you yesterday that I think the baseline requirement for technical understanding has changed. So it's really enriching to be surrounded by very technical people understanding the implications of how they run their teams, how their developers are feeling, what the organization is trying to achieve. These weren't lenses I necessarily saw 6-8 years ago in the community as much from technical people. It would always be from team leads, product owners, or VCs, but to actually have technical leads on stage talking about team topologies, collaboration methods, for me is really exciting. In terms of what's going on in the ecosystem, I think it's amazing to see it so people strong. The sheer volume of people here talking about essentially one tool, but all the different places we could take it, gives me a lot of confidence that it's something that is going to be around for some time and is worth contributing to.
And what about in terms of a theme? Do you feel like there's certain themes that have popped up?
Ooh, I mean, not that I love the term platform engineering, but that definitely is the theme. You know, we had Platform Engineering Co-located Day yesterday. Congratulations, Paula Kennedy. It was fantastic.
Yes,
loved
amazing,
the talks.
Amazing.
And the high, like the real high quality of that. But then also the recognition of the end user and outcome seems to be a theme. I suspect this has been driven by markets and what could be described as a little bit of cost pressure. So if you link value directly back to profit, that is ultimately financial, right? So often the default position for people is to cut fixed costs, reduce your development costs, and there's many ways that you can do that. It's like your running costs, but also your people and a variety of other things. I think it's given a lens of more focus to the outcome, which I think hopefully means we're actually building more meaningful products, not just more profitable products.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. This has been amazing.
Yes, my pleasure. Lovely to meet you yesterday, and I'm very glad to be here.